Today, continuing my conversation with New York Times columnist Charles M. Blow. His memoir is called Fire Shut Up in My Bones, and it tells the story of his childhood in a tiny, small, rural, virtually segregated town in Louisiana, and his journey to, well, being a New York Times columnist. You tell a great story about going to a science fair,
right.
Your first airplane trip to, I'm not sure where you were flying out of, but going to Knoxville.
Yes.
Tennessee.
Yes, the year I win my way to the International Science Fair, it would be in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Right.
Instead of Brazil or somewhere.
Sao Paulo. Ay caramba. And you know, you go there and you know, you're the biggest deal. You're on the basketball team, you're valedictorian, you know, you're a big deal back home. But you learn pretty quickly you're not such a big deal when you're competing, when you're up against those other kids.
Oh no. I mean, and I had done this project on the Star Wars program, which was big when I was a kid. You know, the Reagan administration and
missile defense.
They were going to shoot down the missiles before they got here, and we no longer had to crouch under our desks and do you know, the drills,
duck
or whatever.
And cover, yeah.
And I did this project about why it wouldn't work. Only I didn't do. I violated the cardinal rule of science project, which is I didn't actually do an experiment. It was like a research project. But because at the district level, which is how you get to the International Science Fair, you get the military judges are a big part of the judging process. And they were fascinated by this idea.
Ah.
And so I win the district fair. And there's a kid who has also done a project on why the missile defense system wouldn't work. But he's a Westinghouse science program winner for his. And it's like, it's mathematical as to why it wouldn't work. And this looks like Egyptian hieroglyphics to me. I have no clue what this kid is doing. And I realized in that moment, like, you might be, like you said, you might be hot stuff in your little town of 1,000 people, but this is the real competition. The world is really tough and they're not going to cut you any slack. And you're going to have to be smarter, and you're going to have to be tougher.
Off you go to college, and being tough is sort of part of your existence there. Talk about the whole, I mean, you went to an HBCU, Grambling,
right.
Great history, and then the whole fraternity thing became your life,
right.
And with the ups and downs. Talk about, I mean, we're seeing this trial now down in Florida, you know, which is sort of a similar thing with the FAMU, you know, drum major and all of that. Talk about the pledging process and then another epiphany you had while driving in a car.
there's
a theme there.
There's so many driving in car epiphanies. Well, yes, I went to school and I ran for freshman class president and won. And the other class presidents, I spent much of my days with them because things we had to do. And they were obsessed with this idea of joining a fraternity, which had never occurred to me. I didn't know anyone who was in a fraternity. It just was not something that I would have ever thought about. And they were interested in just this one. And so I said, okay, if it's good enough for you guys, it's good enough for me. I'll try too. And I made the pledge group. They did not, unfortunately. And part of the pledge process was just incredibly barbaric level of hazing. You kind of try to figure out why is this happening? Why am I allowing it to happen? Trying to process it in some way. And I think that in a way, young boys can very often look for these kind of proving moments in a life to kind of prove how tough, how manly you are, how I can take whatever the world dishes out. And that this process in a way takes advantage of that. I had to, and I kind of fell into it in a way and kind of bought into the craziness. And until I just, you know, I think I was swinging like a pendulum throughout my entire life from one extreme to another. And this was another extreme until I had to say, you know, this is not me. This is too much. And I have to come back to the middle. But it took a while because
You entered as a freshman and you finally left as a junior.
It's not even leaving. I didn't leave. It's just that I just said I had to pull back from all of the craziness. It's easy, I think, to get caught up in it. And it's easy to now to see how much of a culture is built up around hazing. And it's not just fraternities. It is, as you say,
marching
clubs
bands,
and marching bands, military, sports teams. We saw that in New Jersey very recently. It's everywhere. And so part of the reason that I wanted to spend a little time on that and treat it very soberly in the book is because I think that until we actually stop pretending that this doesn't really happen or that it's some sort of victimless crime and people just, you know, you submit to doing it and then you participate when you, you know, when you are now the upper person, upperclassman, whatever the case may be, you do it to the next person and this is just a thing that's done. It's actually not a thing.
Tradition.
That's done. It's,
yeah.
It's incredibly corrosive, I think. And I think that we have to think about what does it mean if you have, you know, whole generations of people who have been cruel in this way to other human beings, and what does that say about us? And so I just wanted to take that moment and say, this is what it looks like. It's not glorious and it is not cool. It's actually very brutal and morally cannot be justified.
My guest is New York Times columnist Charles M. Blow, talking about his memoir, Fire Shut Up in My Bones. You know, the college years, you write about, you know, one of those truths that is known about in the black world, but, you know, white folks are pretty oblivious to what goes on in other cultures. They just kind of assume that, oh, everyone's like us, when that ain't the case. You know, you write about the whole issue of skin tone and hair and how those values shift. And I'm thinking of Spike Lee's movie School Days, where he's got one fraternity, the Jigaboos and the Wannabes.
Yes.
Well, talk about, you know, what, you know, your journey with that. I mean, because you had a number of journeys you were going through in that time period about your own identity.
Right. I'm born in 1970, so you're coming right out of the Civil Rights Movement and into the Black Power era. And so it's, you know, big afros and dashikis. And so being dark-skinned or it's just cool. And it's, you know, there's no, it doesn't have the freighting. Although, you know, the 50s, it did. You know, there's a lot of passing, this concept of kind of racial passing that happens before that. And, you know, straightening of hair and what have you. So I'm born into a period where that is not my existence. So people who look like me are on television and they are sports players look like me. I mean, everybody looks like me. And in the early 80s, that shifts back to what it was sometime before, which is that there becomes a premium placed on lighter skinned people in black community again. It's not a new thing. It's just, again, a pendulum swinging. And I was thrown by that. I didn't understand it. It wasn't my existence up until that point. And, you know, you realize like that. It's not just a world of different racial groups. It is, there's like these interracial skirmishes that are happening. And how do you deal with that? And having to navigate that becomes another part of my life.
You know, your sexual identity is, you write about it sort of throughout the book, your journey to acceptance and understanding and so on. But there's a period right around this college period where you go to Washington because you're, you know, maybe being recruited by the CIA that kind of encapsulates, you know, your sexual identity journey. Can you talk about the CIA and Charles M. Blow?
Right. So, you know, I wanted to be the governor of Louisiana. I did not want to be a spy, but they were interested in me and I thought, oh, this will be a cool thing to have on your resume. So they invited me to the last rounds of interviews in Virginia. And so I flew up and I'm going through all these tests and kind of physical tests, psychological tests, interviews, and it seems to be going incredibly well. And one of the last tests was a lie detector test. And I didn't think anything of it. I wasn't going to lie. It didn't even occur to me that this would even be an issue. And the guy strapped me into the chair and he started asking kind of basic questions, and I'm like fine and answering them. And he asked one question about, you know, have you ever used drugs, which I had never, and I still haven't. And but I had always been around people who were smoking weed,
and to say that would be uncool.
Yes. And I'm like, I kind of freak out because I'm thinking maybe I got a contact high, and so the thing starts scratching wildly, and I realize that it's saying that I'm lying. And before I can even recover from that, he asks, have you ever had sex with a man? And I had the childhood sexual abuse immediately sprang to mind. And I just didn't know how to answer it. You know, is it sex if it's not consensual? If it's not penetrative, is it sex? Is if the person, the abuser, is just an older kid but not yet a man, is how does it, you know,
you
how
got
it,
into the technical
how's
sort
it
of
fit? Yeah, I'm all this is happening and I'm realizing, oh, I have to say something, and I say no, and the thing scratches crazily, and I turn around to the guy and I say, you know, can you just please let me do this over? And I explain my entire life story, and he is not in any way interested in what I'm saying. And he says, fine. And I just said, take the test again. And that time I answer the opposite. I say, yes. And it still says that I'm lying. And I realize that there's no yes or no answer for what has happened to me. I don't know how to process it. I don't know what to say about it.
In some ways, is it fair to say that all of these most challenging aspects of your life really inform what you write about as a columnist?
Well, I do try to write about what I know, what it was most intimate to me. And so, you know, some people talk about diversity, say, oh, Charles, you're the only black columnist at the New York Times. I said, no, I'm the only Southern columnist at the New York Times. And I think that
matters. You're taking Tom Wicker's chair.
Yeah. And so... So I write about the things that I know from growing up, and that is, I write a lot about poverty. I write a lot about disenfranchised populations. I write a lot about social justice and education and teachers, specifically as a part of education, and family and parenting, because I'm a single parent. And all of that is where I feel most natural when I'm writing. I write about politics too, of course. That's kind of the space is built for that. But I really try to remind myself of who I'm talking to. And I try to write as if I'm speaking to someone or explaining something to someone that I grew up with, which kind of informs not just the topic, but also the cadence and beat of the language of the column.
You know, you have a couple of really wonderful lines to describe your own journey. And I think this is, applies to your writing in the column. This is about your acceptance of who you are,
right,
with all of its complexity.
Right.
Daring to step into oneself is the bravest, strangest, most natural, most terrifying thing a person can do, because when you cease to wrap yourself in artifice, you are naked, and when you are naked, you are vulnerable. But vulnerability is the leading edge of truth. Being willing to sacrifice a false life is the only way to live a true one.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Tell you about that. I think that says it all. I do believe that, you know, we are dreadfully afraid of being vulnerable in the world, and that we see it as weakness, and I see it the exact opposite, as strength. That it is when we say that I will not hide, that this is me, and in all of its nakedness, that is truly one of the most courageous things a human being can do. And that vulnerability becomes the very source of strength. And I don't think enough of us realize that is what's happening when you do that. That the very act of standing up becomes assertive. And when we do realize that, and hopefully if we do realize that before we die, I think we grow stronger.
My guest has been Charles M. Blow. His new memoir is Fire Shut Up in My Bones. Thank you so much.
Thank you.